This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we talk to the author of a UW-Madison study that puts a number on how many lives air pollution costs each year. Now, 2 years ago today, Minneapolis resident George Floyd was murdered by a police officer, setting off protests around the globe against police violence toward black people and other marginalized groups. Here's then candidate Joe Biden's address to the nation in 2020 a few days later.
Looking ahead in the first 100 days of my presidency, I've committed to creating a National Police Oversight Commission. I've long believed we need real community policing. We need each and every police department of the country to understand a comprehensive review of their undertake a comprehensive review of their hiring, their training, their de-escalation. Some have already done it. Some are in the process of doing it. The federal government should give the cities and states the tools and the resources they need to implement reforms. More police officers meet the higher standards of their profession. Most of them do it. All the more reason why bad cops should be dealt with severely and swiftly.
Two pieces of news came out this week on the topic. A new executive order from the Biden administration on the use of force by federal agents with guidance for local departments, and a Justice Department mandate that federal officers should intervene if they see excessive use of force from other law enforcement officers. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What are your thoughts on what's changed, what hasn't changed over the last 2 years? What kind of changes would you like to see still? Do you have questions about what we're hearing from the Biden administration this week? Do you work in law enforcement? Has anything changed in your department over the last couple of years? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. Reverend David Cooper joins us now. He served 33 years as a police officer, 21 of those as Madison's chief of police. After his retirement, he was ordained as a priest in the Episcopal Church. He's the author of the book Arrested Development, The Colors That Divide Us, about race and police reform. He has a blog called Improving Police. Reverend Cooper, welcome back to Central Time.
My pleasure. Always nice to be on public radio.
Before we get into some of the specifics from the Biden administration, have you seen significant changes in the way policing is done in the last couple of years since the death of George Floyd?
Well, I think probably most white people would say, oh, yeah, there must be a lot of changes going on. But I think sort of the proof of the pudding here is, you know, how do people of color, you know, see what's happened the last 2 years? And if I'm to be fair, I think I have to look at, there's been a lot of talk. People mean well, and I'm sure the president does. I'm sure every public official, I think the city council in Minneapolis and Mayor Fry certainly you know, speaks very strongly about the need for improvement. And I think it's we're talking about a transformation, and anything we're talking about is going to take this entire nation getting behind some very strong principles in saying this is the kind of police that we want in our democracy, and we have to make those changes. And it's going to take 20 years. It took me 20 years in Madison. It's going to take any system probably a good, well, I'll be fair, we probably made some changes significant after 8 years. It takes time. It takes leadership. It takes people committed to really be strong values about what this country is and our values about people.
We have from the Biden administration an executive order today. It's going to require federal agencies to change, revise their use of force policies, give incentives to local departments to do that with use of force, especially when officers intentionally use potentially deadly force. What's our current state of affairs? What do you think needs to change?
Well, you know what we're, you know, it's very nice that we have this from the Attorney General. I'm sure everybody means well. All the things that we've talked about in the last 2 years, since George Floyd was so brutally murdered on the streets of Minneapolis, has been done in one way or another by progressive police departments 40, 50 years ago. This is not new. The Madison Police Department has, since the early 1970s, had a policy that we implemented, said that officers are responsible to step in if they see bad behavior, illegal behavior, policy violations from their fellow officers. We also prohibited the shooting at fleeing motor vehicles and had a procedure to stop high-speed chases that were just getting too dangerous. This is about chokeholds. We decided that we are going to prohibit those in those early days as well. So for someone who's, you know, been in policing for since 1960 and has watched the field and kept an eye on what's going on, and the kind of commitment that I have both as a police officer and a priest to see justice in this country, it is amazing that that this has not been, you know, standard practice. So executive order from the Attorney General talks about officers, duty to intervene, any officer. Well, I think there needs to be a definition. Is the Attorney General talking about federal police officers, Secret Service, FBI, Bureau of ATF? Does it just mean within those federal officers, or are we going to expect federal officers who are at a scene of, say, a demonstration to step in when police officers are using force illegally against a crowd of protesters? That's going to be a very interesting situation if that's what he means.
Talking to Reverend David Cooper, former Madison Chief of Police for over 20 years, looking at policing in America over the last 2 years since the death of George Floyd. You can join in with your thoughts, maybe your experiences, at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Reverend Cooper, we've talked in the past and you've written a lot about the role of a police officer, the mentality they do their job with, and that's trained into them. Is it guardian or is it warrior? And you worry that it slipped from guardian to warrior. Can you talk about that distinction?
Absolutely. That's been a visible shift probably since 9/11. I think there's been significant shift. There's been a lot of outside trainers going around the country. In fact, there's even a course that many police officers in the country have taken called Killology. And it is outrageous that this is the kind of training that taxpayers are paying for their police to have. We also, you know, I've been arguing for quite a few years now that we take the European Union standard of deadly force use, and I see that word was not used. I think the Attorney General talks about use force when necessary. The EU standard, and all EU nations must sign on to this, is that the use of deadly force can only be when it is an absolute necessity, And I think that's got to be the standard. It certainly involves de-escalation. It certainly involves police officers being better trained as good mental health workers on the street, because you can't be an urban police officer, well, any police officer almost in any town and city, and not really have a part of your job is to be a mental health officer, because a lot of the people in which you're contacting and having interactions with are suffering from mental illness. And I think that's a very, very important part of the job. And to sort of shift this work now, say, okay, now police don't know how to do that very well, so we're going to have mental health workers coming into the situation where we would normally send police. And then certainly goes through my mind is, you know, a lot of people are armed today. We certainly know that all too well. And once they have run into a mentally ill person with a gun, they're going to have to call the police. So I think the job of a police officer is to be a mental health worker as well. And I've always had a high belief in the importance of police to be sort of a social glue in our society. Well-trained police officers who are educated, have high emotional intelligence, are continually trained, led by mature leaders, are respectful to everyone they come in contact with, and are willing to work with community members in solving the problems that community members identify as important in their communities. That is possible. I think we have done that in Madison. I think that that it is a goal that's attainable. Nobody wants to be a police officer today. They didn't when I was hiring in the 60s and 70s as well. One of the things we talked about is, come, we're going to be a domestic peace corps, and you don't like the police? Well, join us. Join us and help us change, because nobody outside can change the police. And that is a very, very true maxim. You can't change the police from the outside. The police have to want to change.
Reverend David Cooper is with us, retired police officer, including 21 years as Madison's chief of police. You can join the conversation about policing in America over the last 2 years since the death of George Floyd. 800-642-1234 is the number to call. Do you want to see changes in police training, in transparency? Does the lead have to come from the federal government, or do you see hope for positive changes at the local level? What questions do you have for our guest about the changes he's calling for? 800-642-1234 is the number. That's 800-642-1234. We'll pick up the conversation coming up here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk with Reverend David Cooper, retired police officer, former chief of police in Madison, author of the book Arrested Development, about policing reform. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's go to your calls now. Steve is with us in New Glarus. Hi, Steve.
Hi, how you doing? Yeah, I just wanted to mention it. I was a Chicago police officer, and I worked an all-black district, and my partner was black. His first name was Tim. That's the only name I'm going to give you. But he was 7 feet tall and weighed over 300 pounds, and I felt pretty safe working a two-man car with him. He was, I'm sure, kept me going for quite a while. But he walked in, he was off duty, and he walked into a bar down the block from where he lived. He walked into the bar, and it was an all black neighborhood, and the people in the bar were all black, and the one guy in the bar pulled out a gun and shot and killed my partner. He said, "That's what you get for working for Whitey." And I just wanted to say, you know, you would think after all these years, I mean, I'm 77 years old now. And we're talking about something that happened 50 years ago, and we haven't gotten any better. We haven't developed. We haven't grown any better. We're still just, I don't know. I don't know what to say.
Steve, thank you for sharing your story. I'm sorry about the loss of your partner. I can tell you're still feeling it today. Reverend Cooper, Steve feels like the divide, the suspicion, I think, between police and black communities, not any better than when he was a cop.
Yeah, I think he's right. I think he's very right. And it's a sad commentary for those of us who have sort of, you know, watched this field and have served in this field. I certainly felt that when I retired in the 1990s, that that the die was cast and that we as a nation would continue to improve. But I think right now, there's one positive thing I think coming out as Assistant Attorney General Gupta. She said that that there's and I'm going to do some research on this. I just found out this just. Earlier today, that there's having a knowledge lab and that they're trying to develop best practices in the police field, which I think is really good. But we're also talking about 18,000 separate police agencies in 50 states and about 600,000 police officers with all kinds of variations in standards for their hiring. It is seemingly an insurmountable problem, even when we were sort of willing to dialogue between left and right in this country. Now that everyone has sort of run to the side that either the police are all bad or the police are all good and leave them alone, they're just doing their job, we never will have that dialogue that I think is so essential in the middle to try to come to some agreement as to, you know, what are the, you know, the standards and conditions and training, and what are the kind of people we want. And I used to, in fact, I noted this, I think in my book, I talked about, we had a citizens panel interviewing a number of police officers over the years, sort of kind of a final approval of having the community involved and not just the government officials in selecting police. And I remember one person on the panel saying, well, Chief, what are you looking for? What kind of person do you want in the police department? And the story I gave them was this. I said, imagine your teenage daughter has 2 hours late coming home, and you're up, you and your wife are up and worried about this, and maybe thinking about, well, should we call the police? And all of a sudden, she's knocking at the door. She comes in, she's crying. She's been beaten up. Now, what kind of person do you want to come into your home, in your living room, and try to sort this out and help find out what's happened to her? That's the kind of police officer that I think this country needs. And I think we've got a lot of them out there. They're very reluctant to speak up because the subculture in which police work is overpowering. It changes people. It's difficult to go up against what you think is the stream. But the reality is there's more good cops out there than there's bad cops. And Derek Chauvin was a bad cop, and there's not a whole bunch of bad cops like that in Minneapolis. I worked there for 7 years when I started my career. But what there is a lot of other police officers that will not stand up and challenge, you know, a senior opinion leader like Derek Chauvin within a police department. They simply won't do it. Call it survival. It just doesn't happen very often.
Let's go back to our callers now. Jim is with us on the road near Madison. Jim, hi.
Good afternoon.
What did you want to tell us about, Jim?
Well, I could probably agree with some of the things the gentleman is commenting on. Some of it I don't. But just to give you some perspective from my point of view, I spent 38 years in law enforcement. 31 of those years, I was a street police officer in a major metropolitan city in the Midwest, a big city that is having many problems today. The last years of my career, of that 38 years, I spent specifically working in police training. In that period of time, I did find, from my perspective, a lot of problems with the methodology, the new methodology in police training. Most of it was good, but some of it was bad. And what I would refer to as far as use of force is concerned, a lot of the technological aspects of the training, the shoot, don't shoot stuff and all that kind of stuff, I did not agree with, and I made it known to my superiors, fell on deaf ears. And I think in a lot of big organizations, the institutional thinking is the ideas from the bottom never get to the top. There's this kind of, you know, pecking order kind of thing. And the gentleman making the comments there, he made the references that there's institutional thinking where, you know, you've got people that kind of set the tone of things and the other people are afraid to comment on it. I didn't find that to be the case much. It did in some areas. But, you know, what I think is happening today also is that the police departments are getting beat up constantly. Okay, they're getting beat up in the media. They're getting beat up by civic organizations and all these other entities on the outside. So it creates that circle of wagons mentality within police organizations. Also, I will say,
I'm going to jump in, Jim, because we don't have too much time left. And you gave us a lot to talk about there. Reverend Cooper, you've written that you're hoping to see not such, I think, correct me if I'm not paraphrasing you right, not such a confrontational approach, you know, community against police, federal government consent decrees against a department, more of a collaborative approach so that, as Jim says, we don't circle the wagons so much. Can you talk about how to do that?
I'd be interested in him identifying what he doesn't agree with what I said. That would be interesting to see that we may have had careers around parallel times, some overlapping there. I'm probably a little older than he is, but what is it that Jim thinks that should not be done here, that we're barking up the wrong tree? I'd be interested. Changes in use of force policies, what about getting a hold of guns? You know, there's some way that we can, regulate guns like we have automobiles. Is there some way we can have smart weapons? There's technology out there that'll prevent a person from firing a firearm that isn't his or her own. Some of that is that going to have to be done, because there's far too many guns on the street. That I would put it right out there. There's too many guns out there, and guns kill cops, and cops should be very much involved in trying to regulate the number of guns that are out there and who's carrying them. That's an important part. How many children do we get shot in school? I'm sick and tired of it, and most everyone is. Let's do something.
Jim, thanks for that call. Reverend Cooper, in just our last few moments, do you have any optimism that more departments are going to make some of the changes that you've been hoping for?
Well, my faith tells me to have hope, that as a person of faith, I will always have hope. As a former police leader watching the field for all these years and watching what's gone on since 2020, I will have to say that I am very, very worried that we will not be able to, in the near future, make the necessary change to have police officers who are then respected by the communities they serve and supported by them. Because a police officer in America cannot do his or her job without having trust and support from the community. It is impossible. That's how you turn into a warrior, where the objective is to use fear and intimidation.
And that's
good policing involves community.
That's where we'll leave it. Thanks to Reverend David Cooper, retired police officer, former Madison chief of police for over two decades, author of the book Arrested Development, The Colors That Divide Us. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, a Madison-based artist tells us about her work to raise awareness of missing and murdered Indigenous women, including a music video she filmed to mark the official Day of Awareness earlier this month. Now, more than 100,000 Americans die each year because of stroke, heart attack, and other causes linked to air pollution. That's according to a 2019 National Academy of Sciences report. Now, a study from UW-Madison finds that over 50,000 deaths could be prevented each year if certain kinds of air pollution were eliminated. Nick Mayu is a graduate student at UW-Madison's Nelson Institute for Environmental Studies and lead author of this study on air pollution. Nick, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Well, tell us what you set out to find out here.
Yeah, so what we tried to do with this study was understand if we were able to eliminate sources of air pollution from electricity, transportation, buildings, and industry, which we dub energy-related in the study, what would the benefits to public health be? And part of the motivation for this work was that these are some of the same sectors that contribute greatly to planet warming climate pollution, in addition to air pollution that leads to hundreds of thousands of deaths, like you mentioned.
And eliminating all those sources sounds like a pretty tall order, but why did you want to look at what could happen if you could take those completely off the map?
Yeah, it's definitely a challenge to get emissions reductions on the scale that we look at in here, but really we're just trying to put a stake in the ground to say, if we were able to do this mammoth task, this is the scale of benefit that we could get.
Can you connect the dots for us between these sources of air pollution and diseases that we might not think of an air pollution link, things like lung cancer, heart attacks, and more?
Yeah, well, part of the problem with the types of air pollution we look at here, so we're primarily focused on something called fine particulate matter, which people might generally think of as soot. And the real problem there with this pollutant and why it leads to so much health harm is that it's small enough. So it's about a 30th of the width of a human hair, to give an analogy. And that's small enough that when you inhale this walking around outside during the day at any time, it's small enough that it can go it can bypass your reflex. So if you inhale something larger, you might cough, you might get a cough reflex and emit it back out, and then you don't have to worry about it. But these are small enough that just going about your day breathing, they're able to get deep down into your lungs and potentially even into your bloodstream.
You looked at national data, but you found that the Midwest could stand to benefit the most from getting rid of air pollution. Why is that?
Yeah, so we, like you said, we nationwide, we found that we could avoid about 53,000 lives, or we could save 53,000 lives, rather, each year by eliminating sources of pollution from these sectors. And a little over 11,000 of those avoided deaths would come in the Midwest alone. Now, there's a couple different reasons for this. One is that we're wind patterns generally move west to east in the United States, and we're downwind of much of the rest of the United States, which are also emitting pollutants. And there are also large population centers in the Midwest, particularly in Chicago and in Ohio as well. So just the more people you have exposed to air pollution, the more potential benefit you get from reducing sources of pollution. And another factor here is also that we have a lot of coal fire electricity still in the Midwest compared to other regions, especially in the Ohio River Valley with Indiana and Ohio. And that coal fired electricity emits a lot more pollutants per unit energy created. So the potential benefit is greater by shutting down sources of pollution from coal.
You may have just answered this question, but are there low hanging fruits here where readily available changes in air pollution could make a big difference, even if we don't get rid of all of these pollutants?
Yes. Yeah. You preempted the question there. definitely. The lowest hanging fruit in these sectors is probably coal fire electricity generation. So that's one that we've actually had a lot of progress eliminating sources of coal from our electricity grid over the last couple decades. So there's been tremendous health benefits already gained by reducing sources of emissions from coal. But it's the question of getting the rest of it off the grid would probably be the lowest hanging fruit. And the electricity sector generally is going to be the easiest of these sectors to decarbonize. We have a lot of the tools and technologies already available to us to get to a nearly emissions-free electricity grid nationwide in the U.S.
I think a lot of the conversations I've had about things like clean energy and pollution reduction lately have centered around climate change. Do you think that these health impacts need to be more on the map and more part of the policy discussions?
Yeah, I definitely think they do. One of the reasons that we even do this kind of study is partly to say that, yes, these are the same sources of emissions that contribute to global warming and climate-related impacts, but they're also causing tremendous harm to our health every single year, year after year, all across the United States. And you might have to wait 20, 30 years to get the full benefit of avoided global warming from removing emissions from these sources. So that's the climate warming, CO2 pollution, and others. But the benefit you get to human health from removing emissions of fine particulate matter start to accrue immediately after you eliminate a source of emissions. You don't have to wait at all.
You've got this study out. What are your next steps in looking at sources of pollution and the link to our health?
Yeah, so some next steps will be similar studies, but with this study, we asked the question, if you could just flip a switch and tomorrow all these sources were gone, what would the benefit be? But that's obviously not the timeline that reality works under. And a transition to a full clean energy economy is inevitably going to play out over the course of decades. So some of the next steps are trying to understand the timing of these changes, when we could expect changes of these scales or even half the scale to manifest under different future scenarios, and trying to understand what the cumulative benefit would be over that time. So over the next 20, 30 years, how many lives could we save in total from ratcheting down emissions from these sources?
Nick, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Yeah, thank you.
Nick Mayhew is a graduate student at UW-Madison's Nelson Institute for Environmental Studies. He talked to us about his study finding that eliminating air pollution caused by the energy sector would prevent over 50,000 deaths in the United States each year. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a story about the Ojibwe practice of spearfishing.
Spearfishing is a tradition practiced every spring by Ojibwe tribes in northern Wisconsin. It's a practice that's been passed on for generations, and it's part of tribal rights to hunt, fish, and gather on lands ceded to the U.S. government under federal treaties reached nearly 200 years ago. Earlier this month, WPR's Daniel Kading tagged along with a group from the Lac des Flambeaux Band of Lake Superior, Chippewa, as they taught tribal youth the time-honored tradition of spearfishing.
Lac des Flambeaux Tribal President John Johnson Sr. says the tradition of spearfishing is at the heart of the tribe's name.
When the French came here, they seen our people out in canoes with torchlights, and that's why they call it Lake of the Torches here in Lac des Flambeaux or Wiswaugenie.
That's the Ojibwe word for the tribe, which Johnson says means Lake of the Fire. For hundreds of years, tribal members harvested fish by torchlight in birch bark canoes at night. As the sun sets over Little Trout Lake near Lac des Flambeaux, Johnson and other tribal members are preparing to take tribal youth out to spearfish for walleye, or oga. Before they head out, young kids take part in a drum ceremony. They sing several songs, including one for tobacco, or asema. Johnson tells the kids to place tobacco in the water. Ojibwe language and cultural teacher Wayne Valier explains Mishipishu, a great water panther, protects the water on behalf of the Anishinaabe people.
When he sees the Anishinaabe putting their tobacco in the water, that makes them happy and pleasant. And what that'll do for us is that'll calm the lake for us. So it'll make it easy for the Anishinaabe to harvest and see the fish.
The group loads up their boats with large tin buckets and aluminum spears around 12 to 16 feet long. Johnson is heading out with his 11-year-old grandson, Ganebic Johnson. Ganebic says he usually goes out with his granddad, who's taught him to share what they harvest to feed their community.
It's important to Native people, and we do this to provide our families, and we just hope we don't get harassed.
Just over 30 years ago, hundreds of people harassed tribal spearfishers at boat landings in northern Wisconsin. They hurled rocks and racist remarks after a federal judge upheld tribal treaty rights to hunt, fish, and gather on off-reservation lands. While there's no sign of trouble on this night, Johnson says not all people know or understand their rights.
They don't realize that we utilize the woods for our food, the lakes for food, and we try to be respectful for it. And we try to save some for the next generation.
Out on the water, Johnson slows the boat as he heads toward a spot near the shoreline where walleye are spawning. His grandson and grandnephew, Liam Armstrong, wear a helmet with a headlamp attached. Johnson says they shine the light from side to side on the shallow water.
The eyes glow. That's all you gotta do is catch a glimpse.
It's not long before his grandson, Ganebic, spears their first walleye of the night.
Right there, Ganebic.
Oh, good one, buddy.
9-year-old Liam eagerly waits his turn.
That's what I want to do when I grow up. Last year, I got 5 walleyes, and it's fun doing this.
Tribal members take kids out in 4 boats that are each allowed to spear 25 fish per permit. They count the walleye and measure them to comply with tribal regulations when they return to shore. Kids then sit around the fire and swap stories about how many fish they speared. 11-year-old Ryan Mendez speared 6 walleye. He says it's cool that they're keeping this tradition alive.
It's a real great thing. I really appreciate it. I like it. I think it's cool that we can all go out in a boat and have fun time, spear some walleyes, and maybe see a big monster coming your way.
The hope is that these kids will learn and practice their culture, language, and traditions so they can pass that on to future generations.
WPR's Daniel Kading brought us that story on spearfishing. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. I'm Maureen McCollum.
Coming up, we learn how a new music video from a Madison-based recording artist aims to help missing and murdered Indigenous women in the United States. That's next here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. Wisconsin marked May 5th as the Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women Day of Awareness. It's the second year that day was recognized also as a National Day of Awareness. In his 2021 proclamation, President Biden said, quote, "Thousands of unsolved cases of missing and murdered Native Americans continue to cry out for justice and healing." Madison-based recording artist Kelly Jackson has been using her music to bring attention to this issue. The Ojibwe singer is originally from the Lac du Flambeau band of Lake Superior Chippewa Indians. Her award-winning albums include Spirit of a Woman and Renditions of the Soul. She recently filmed a music video in Madison for the song Don't Speak, which is from the Renditions of the Soul album. Its premiere was part of an Indigenous-led event raising awareness of violence against women. Kelly, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you so much for the invitation to join you today. I'm excited to share a little bit about what we've been doing in the Madison area.
Well, first I want to share some of your song, Don't Speak. Here's a listen to some of it.
She cries in the dark, shadows in her thoughts, shame overcomes what can't be undone, cold sweats, torn flesh, lost innocence, my independence. Don't speak, don't cry, don't ask, don't try, it's all you can do. What we do to get by, it's how we survive.
Kelly, can you tell us some about this song and the inspiration for it?
Wow. Well, to be honest, you know, Spirit of a Woman, my first album, was a tribute to all of the women in my life, aunties, mother, friends, relatives who have helped guide me. I think all of us have had influential women in our lives that, you know, really have uplifted us or kind of lift as they climb. And so my first album was really focused on more of an uplifting kind of environment, where Renditions of the Soul really touched on topics that are a little harder and a little more difficult to process. And I think music's always been an incredible medicinal tool for myself and for my community. And so Don't Speak was really inspired by my own, you know, my own survival, if you will, as a victim of, you know, sexual and physical violence. And I really wanted to explore, you know, more deeply, you know, how this had an impact on me personally. But I guess it also really reflected the fact that I come from an Indigenous community, which is, you know, truly the statistics and the information are very startling when it comes to violence against Indigenous women. And I wanted to, you know, really create a conversational piece that would make it okay to start talking about, about this topic. And so Don't Speak was really inspired at the opposite of that, is we're sort of told not to talk about it. It's embarrassing, it's humiliating. And yet the song is really inspiring the idea of we do have to talk about these things. And most importantly, that you're not alone, that there are so many of us, and not just Indigenous women, but women in general, that have had to face, you know, the life events of trauma. And it was a piece that inspired, you know, the, you know, recognition of survival, and even more is the thrival or the thriving that's necessary after someone encounters that experience.
Do you feel like the ice is breaking when people hear your song, for example? Do they say, do they think maybe now it's time for me to speak up?
Without a doubt. And I think the song was actually released in 2015, and I would perform it, you know, throughout the world when I was performing. And it always was something that I was highly sensitive of. And oftentimes I wouldn't perform it because maybe it wasn't the appropriate event. But I found that when I did perform it, almost always I would have someone encounter me saying, wow, that really resonated with me. I really had this experience. And, you know, it really was a powerful, you know, expression through music. And so it really made me realize as time went on and as the missing and murdered Indigenous women efforts have really started to, you know, move more into a global spotlight, how it was even more important to bring this, you know, to the surface. And what better way to do that but through, you know, a visual presentation of the song. And it was very challenging for me because I'm not a mental health provider. I'm not an expert in, you know, this area. I'm simply, you know, an Indigenous woman who's experienced that but wants to be part of the conversation. And so even in order to put that visual together and to create and record a music video, I found myself reaching out to other women, women who had been working in the profession, women that had experienced trauma in their life, women that have, you know, looked at how to make an impact, how to impact change. I also talked to other men and Indigenous men on how and what their role could or can be in order to impact change. And it really came together, this idea of in the music video being very diverse, that this happens to all different types of women. And so the video showcases a veteran, a, you know, college student, a woman in a domestic scenario, and then, of course, children of sexual assault by a family member. So we tried to be as diverse as we could and yet sensitive enough to, you know, not show actual moments of trauma, although it does have very limited amounts of that. But it, we wanted to capture the diversity that this issue impacts. And so it was a challenge in the whole construction. But the storyline definitely resonates with a lot of people. And I felt like what a great, you know, a step forward to not just having the conversation, but to launching a nationwide awareness campaign and also essentially a fundraising campaign.
Right.
And I know one of the challenges that I'm faced just as an individual is just when you ask someone, how are you going to impact change? How are you going to impact the better protection of women and girls? How are you going to impact the better services that are provided to women who are in a, you know, victim cycle service line? How do you create change? And I don't think I really know how to do that. And I think the initial launch of this is more information seeking, asking for people's guidance and help on what is the best way for us to utilize music and essentially a partnership. So we've partnered with the Gray Wolf Foundation, which is a local Madison nonprofit organization that is helping us collect revenue and then ultimately helping us decide how to distribute those revenue sources to make the biggest impact. But we do certainly invite advice from others who are working in this sector to help us become better stewards of the awareness campaign, but also where resources can be allocated to make the biggest and most aggressive impact.
And Kelly, you've got this new video, this big partnership, as you say, inviting people to give their perspectives. How would you encourage people to think about this and then to take a step to get involved, whether that's through reaching out to this effort or doing something in their own community?
Well, I think first and foremost, the video itself is called Don't Speak, which is sort of the absolute opposite of what we're looking for. But that's just sort of the message that we're conveying now is that let's have a conversation. Let's, after this radio program is over, you know, just being able to, as a family, as a community, start having the conversation about what are the services available in your community? What are the challenges that are facing your local communities? Is there a way for you to get engaged locally or even just to be an advocate for your family or community in some way? So that would be the first call to action. The second would be to reach out to Gray Wolf Foundation. He is definitely collecting advice on how to better serve, you know, this particular cause and is, you know, currently accepting donations as we speak. They are also putting together what we're calling emergency care packages, which will include, you know, the critical items that a woman or victim may need when they're leaving a traumatic scenario and find themselves without any of the unique and essential items that are needed. So, it, you know, a backpack with essential items, including a phone and gas card and also just knowing from the community what other services or items might be better served in these packages. So, you know, donations, feedback through the Gray Wolf Foundation. I certainly personally am willing to talk with folks who are interested in reaching out and having a more in-depth conversation with me about how to be a better advocate. We also would like to partner with other foundations and organizations that have similar plights, if you will.
Kelly, we'll leave it there. Thanks for joining us again today.
Absolutely. And thank you so much for the invitation. I really appreciate being part of the highlighted programs today. And I really do look forward to working with WPR in the future. So Chimigwich in my language, big thank yous.
Thank you. Kelly Jackson is a Madison-based Ojibwe recording artist, originally from the Lac du Flambeau band of Lake Superior Chippewa Indians. Been talking about her song and new music video, Don't Speak, raising awareness of violence against women. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, a lot of people switching jobs during the pandemic. Is that the new normal? That and more tomorrow here on Central Time.